Chapter 8 of 2 Corinthians. Before we proceed into the chapter, we need to look at two preliminary questions first. The first question is, why does Paul suddenly change the subject here? This looks like a really abrupt change in the subject. So why does Paul change the subject, and how, and perhaps even does this fit in with what he was saying before? Some people say, oh, it doesn't fit in at all. It's a different letter that somehow got stuck in here. So we need to ask that question about this change in subject. The second question we need to examine before we even get to verse 1 is, how can we explain Paul's seeming obsession with the poor saints in Jerusalem? He addresses the subject in several of his letters. There were poor saints elsewhere, not just in Jerusalem. In some cases, he's asking poor saints elsewhere to contribute to the poor saints in Jerusalem. What is the reason for Paul's repeated emphasis on that particular problem in that particular city? So those are the two questions I want to look at before we even get to verse 1 of chapter 8. So the first question, why does Paul change the subject here? And is this a change in subject? Well, I think we would all agree it is a change in subject. It shifts rather abruptly here in chapters 8 and 9 to focus on the need of the poor saints for these funds. And this sudden turn in argument, which some argue really has nothing to do with what proceeds, has caused many to think, well, this is an independent letter and it somehow got stuck in here and doesn't really belong. But that's not the case at all. There are ties between chapters 8 and 9 and what's gone on before. Paul talked about Titus in chapter 7, and that provides an appropriate connection to what Paul's about to talk about, in which Titus will play a major role. He's just switching more his style than his subject. He's becoming more of an administrator here. The tone takes on a more administrative tone as Paul is arranging the details of this contribution. Paul mentions that his afflictions when he arrived in Macedonia. He talks about those in chapter 7. And here he talks about the Macedonians also undergoing afflictions in chapter 8. In fact, the description of the afflictions in chapter 8 matches what Paul said about the afflictions all the way back in chapter 1. There are ties between chapters 8 and 9 and the rest of the letter. These chapters belong right here where they are. One of the themes in this letter is how Paul's afflictions issue in life for others, how they transfer into life, and how afflictions in general cause life for others. He talks about that in chapter 4, for example. Well, here, the Macedonians' afflictions and their extreme poverty that resulted in overflowing joy and this extraordinary desire to help others. Again, that fits in with that theme. One commentator noted that, you know, the church's need of money is a matter which is difficult to handle with graciousness, sensitivity, and dignity. Close quote. But Paul handles this issue very well in these two chapters. And I think his lengthy discussion of these kind of administrative issues show just how important that type of thing is for the success of this ministry and any ministry. Paul was a detail person, in addition to being a grand theme person, but he could get down and do the details that needed to be done. And in these chapters, we see Paul the administrator, who does not shy away from handling the essential details that needed to be taken care of. And he delivered theological pep talks to those who had grown weary and were flagging in their zeal. He delegated responsibilities when he needed to do that. He soothed ruffled feathers when he needed to do that. He wanted to get the job done, and he did get the job done. You know, having a grand plan is very important. But absent someone who knows how to get things done, all we'll ever have is a grand plan. Paul knew how to get things done, and we see him doing that right here. You know, this Jerusalem project offered the Corinthians a chance to participate in something greater than themselves. You know, generosity is not something that's really innate to human beings, but that's no less true of Christians than others. But in these two chapters, Paul shows why and how the Corinthian Christians should and contribute to that fund for the Jerusalem Christians. So these chapters fit perfectly in with the rest of the letter, as we'll see. These were not tacked on at all. The second question we wanted to consider before we launch into chapter 8 is, why does Paul invest so much energy and time into this particular collection, for this particular group? There were other poor people, other poor Christians around. Why is it that this one is so important to Paul? It's Romans and the other Corinthian letter. He talks about it in other letters of his, and you can see just how important it is. Well, several reasons have been given as possibilities for why this particular collection was so important. Well, first, and basic reason is that it was an act of almsgiving to relieve the poverty of the church there in Jerusalem. And, you know, although Paul hardly touches on the need of the saints in Jerusalem here, he does refer to that in Romans chapter 15, the poor of the saints who are in Jerusalem. He mentions their lack in chapter 8, verse 14, and in chapter 9, verse 12. We know famine was not unfamiliar at all at this time. We've seen that elsewhere in these letters, in fact. It prompted an earlier relief effort in Acts chapter 11. Some had voluntarily given up their goods to help those in the community. Acts chapter 4. You know, the church there must have also been facing severe persecution. And that must have also compounded their poverty. Because they could not turn to the unbelieving Jews in the community for help. I'm sure they've been ostracized. So they were together and there was no one else to help them in that city. Except perhaps help from outside, which is what Paul was trying to do. And, of course, almsgiving was a big part of Judaism, and Paul would have been deeply influenced by that, all that the Old Testament has to say about caring for the poor. And, of course, the practice of the church also, particularly the early church, was to help others who were in need and to share with them with the finances. So we have all those motivations going on that I think must have played a part here. But I still think that there must have been something else, something of a greater significance to Paul than just that. You know, if the need in Jerusalem is so urgent, this process was taking a long time. I mean, look at the length of time that has gone on here as Paul is trying to arrange this. And there's a particular reason I think that Paul wants to go personally and deliver it. And we'll see that in just a moment. Paul is doing something more than just sending a check into Jerusalem. There's something else involved here. Well, what is it? A second possibility that has been put forward is that Paul was discharging an obligation he had to the Jerusalem church. Excuse me. In Galatians chapter 2, we see a meeting recorded between the so-called pillar apostles of the Jerusalem church, James, Peter, and John, and Paul. And Paul, as you recall, says, well, they did not add anything to my gospel, but they did recognize and affirm my ministry, and they gave me the right hand of fellowship. We had this meeting. But in verse 10 of Galatians 2, he says, they ask only that I remember the poor. All right. Well, perhaps there's some kind of an obligation that was put on Paul that he is now discharging as he remembers the poor back in Jerusalem where that meeting occurred. But, you know, Paul also says that he would have done that on his own initiative. He says that in the same context. And his eagerness and his fervent desire to see this project carried through throughout his letters, I think it points to more than just discharging some obligation that these pillar apostles laid on him. He does mention that there is some debt involved that's being repaid. He mentions that in Romans 15, verse 27. But he says that is a spiritual debt. That's a spiritual debt that the Gentiles owe to the Jerusalem congregation because the Word of God, as we know, started off on the day of Pentecost in Jerusalem. And I think there is a spiritual debt as that spread out. But I still don't think that's quite enough to explain why this is so important to the Apostle Paul. But, you know, before I leave that second point, Paul may have felt another sense of debt. And that is because he had violently persecuted the church. And so he may have been he was the reason for a lot of the persecution. He may have felt he was still the reason for some of the financial distress that they were in. It's possible that he felt that he had a special debt to them for that reason. But you know, you read Galatians 2, that I just referred to, and that does not betray any sense on the Apostle Paul's part of any such debt that he feels on that sense. So even if he did feel such a debt, I still don't think that's the primary motive behind these efforts. The third possible reason that's been put forward for Paul's keen interest in the Jerusalem problem is that his service, he felt, might not be accepted by the saints there. And I think that's a crucial piece of evidence. Romans 15, verse 31. He said there, "Pray that I may be rescued from the unbelievers in Judea, and that my service in Jerusalem may be acceptable to the saints there." That, I think, is a crucial clue as to why this particular problem was so important to the Apostle Paul. If this were simply an emergency relief effort for people who were starving, why does Paul need to ask the Romans to pray that those poor people will find his gift acceptable? The answer, I think, is to be found in the long history of conflict over the acceptance of the uncircumcised Gentile Christians by the more traditional law-observing Jewish Christians. The problem was that this money was Gentile money. If the Jewish Christians accepted this Gentile money, this tangible sign of love and indebtedness from the Gentile Christians, then they have in effect accepted them as their brothers in Christ and their fellow heirs of the promises. The collection shows that the Christian faith, I think, can overcome these deep racial barriers that existed at that time. It formally separated the Jews from the Gentiles. And as you read through Paul's other letters, Ephesians chapter 2, for example, you can see that is such an important problem to the Apostle Paul. He wanted to break down that wall of barrier that separated them. I think the concern here is to show solidarity between Jew and Greek in Christ. And I think that is the primary motive for this contribution. You know, Paul did not organize collections, as far as we know, for the other churches who suffered persecution and poverty. He saw something special here about the Jewish problem in Jerusalem. Paul wanted to do more than just send them relief. He wanted to establish unity between Jewish Christian and Gentile Christian. He wanted all to belong together to the one church and have that middle wall of hostility broken down. And that, I think, is the basis, the reason why this was so important to Paul. The church then would then know the unity of the Spirit and the bond of peace. You know, if Paul were just sending relief aid to Jerusalem, he could have sent it on with messengers from others. But he wanted to deliver the gift in person. Why? Because he wanted to make sure it was properly interpreted by those who received it. As evidence of the bond between Jewish Christian and Gentile Christian in the one church. I think that's the reason it was so important to the Apostle Paul. You know, one final note before we launch into the chapter. You know, we've grown accustomed today to receiving these appeals for donations from a wide variety of sources. We, of course, collect money within the church today to send off and help others. But we see it on TV as you have various, you know, Band-Aids and all these different aid groups that get together and send off. We're used to that today. This was virtually unknown at this time. This was not something that happened. The thought of someone going around to these cities and collecting money to send it off to some other city, I mean, it was just unknown at this time. This is really the beginning of that, as you look back through history. It's a beautiful point to think that all that we see today started off here in the church, with Paul collecting this money to send off to the church there in Jerusalem. Verses 1 through 5 of chapter 8. "Moreover, brethren, we do you to wit of the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia, how that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality. For to their power I bear record, yea, and beyond their power they were willing of themselves, praying us with much entreaty that we would receive the gift and take upon us the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. And this they did, not as we hoped, but first gave their own self to the Lord and to us by the will of God." Paul begins his appeal by informing the Corinthians how the grace of God has been given to the churches in Macedonia. Presumably that would be Philippi, Thessalonica, and Berea. In particular, remember that includes Philippi, because we're going to be looking at the book of Philippians here in a moment and some things that were said there. But that's one of the congregations there in Macedonia. Grace is a key word that appears 10 times throughout these two chapters. with different nuances, but it's a key word in this discussion, grace. Here it refers to human generosity, but Paul understands that to be something given by God. Grace, of course, as we know, is God's unconditional benevolence toward us, toward mankind. And when people are spontaneously generous toward others, Paul takes that as clear evidence of God's grace working in them and through them. You know, the gift of money to others has been called a visible sign of an invisible grace. It's interesting that Paul here does not say that God's grace here lightens the Macedonians' afflictions. He doesn't say it's going to remove your poverty. You know, you give to the Jerusalems and God is going to rain denarii down on you. That's not at all what Paul says. Instead, it opens their hearts and their purse strings to help others, this generosity that comes out from the grace of God. Paul hopes the Corinthians will take heart from the example of the Macedonians. You know, it may seem as you read this, well, Paul's just playing one church off against another. He's playing off the impoverished churches against the affluent churches. He's playing off the north against the south. No, Paul is not stooping to gimmicks here in fundraising. He's not trying to raise a larger amount of money by inciting some type of competition for fundraising. The amount is not what is important here. It's the spirit behind the giving that is important. Corinth was an affluent congregation. They probably could have written a check from their surplus that far outweighed what the Macedonians have been able to give. But if the spirit of the giving, I mean, that would not at all have matched the Macedonians. If all the Corinthians had done is scrape off some of their surplus, the Macedonians were giving out of their poverty. If the Corinthians wanted to compete with the Macedonians, then they should compete for the most joyful and willing attitude of giving, not over the amount of money that's contributed. Paul commends the Macedonians for their overflowing joy and their willingness to sacrifice in the midst of their own suffering and their poverty. Paul asserts, however, that the Macedonians can't take any credit for that. Again, it all comes from God's grace that had been given to them. Paul bases his appeal to the Corinthians on the grace of God that continues to be richly poured out in their lives through Jesus Christ. And that's important, that Paul's approach to fundraising here is grounded in solid theological principles. That's what Paul keeps pointing back to. Theology, why they're giving, pointing back to the cross and the grace of God and Jesus and what he had done. And that should lead the Corinthians, that just should lead all of us to think and to ask, where is the evidence of the grace of God in our lives? How can people see the grace of God working in our lives? And that's the question I think that Paul keeps raising to the Corinthians throughout this chapter. Verse 2 that we read a moment ago, the Macedonians experienced an upwelling of generosity during a severe test of affliction. You know, the New Testament evidence suggests they were no strangers to persecution and affliction. We see it in Acts, Philippians, 1 Thessalonians, throughout. They were persecuted severely. The word test, that's translated test here, has a different nuance than the word for testing that is related to temptation. The word used here really points more to the positive outcome of the test, that you've come through the test and you've had a positive outcome. The test has proved Christian character. That's really what's being pointed to here in the use of the word. The Macedonians were suffering from extreme poverty. The phrase Paul uses is best expressed as down to the depths of poverty. They were down about as far as you could go with poverty. At this time, a lot of these people worked in trade guilds. And to continue working in that trade guild, you had to take a pinch of incense and offer it to Caesar as God. And they refused to do that, and they were kicked out of those trade guilds. And they didn't have a livelihood. How easy it would have been to rationalize that. Well, I know it's not easy, there's not God. I've got to make a living. I've got to do this to make a living. And when I make a living, I'll be able to do so much more for God with my... No. They did not do that. They did not compromise. And for that reason, they suffered severe economic hardship. In spite of this persecution and this poverty, though, they experienced an abundance of joy, which resulted in this wealth of generosity. You know, in the New Testament, the Christian's experience of joy has no correlation to his outward circumstances. I think that's something we've kind of lost. As we look back at the New Testament, they were joyous in the most horrible circumstances. You know, paradoxically, Christians can experience joy in the midst of great persecution and personal suffering and poverty. You know, the poverty overflowing into wealth. I mean, it's a paradox. One commentator called it the crazy quilt, the crazy quilt logic of the gospel. The joy plus affliction plus poverty equals wealth. And of course, it's not material, it's spiritual wealth. It's the wealth that comes from our spiritual riches in Jesus Christ. Material wealth, on the other hand, it can cloak poverty. It can cloak spiritual poverty. Remember Christ's condemnation of the wealthy Laodiceans in Revelation 3? That church considered itself rich and prospering. Jesus said, "You're wretched, you're pitiful, you're poor, you're blind, you're naked." That was Jesus' view of that wealthy congregation. But then Jesus looked at Smyrna in Revelation chapter 2, beset by affliction and poverty. And Jesus said, "You're rich, you're rich," he told them. The Macedonian churches were like Smyrna, members of this blessed category in the eyes of the Lord, rich, poor churches, spiritual riches. One commentator wrote, despite all their difficulties, they did not turn inwards. Their concern was for others. What a contrast to the church at Corinth, whose internal divisions risked putting a stumbling block in the way of the conversion of both Jews and Greeks, and even endangered their fellow Christians. Inward versus outward. Turning inward versus turning outward. That's a theme we're going to see in this chapter. In this passage, Paul is too tactful to put things quite that bluntly. But he holds up the supreme sacrifice of the Macedonians in the face of their extreme poverty as an example for the Corinthians. The Macedonians' giving to help others who are also beleaguered in their persecution and their poverty follows the pattern of Jesus Christ, mentioned later in verse 9 of this chapter, who willingly accepted poverty so he could turn it into spiritual riches for others. In verses 3 and 4, Paul says they gave as much as they were able and beyond what they were able. You know, Paul did not ask for any specific amount or percentage. The Macedonians had not prospered and then given from their surplus. Instead, they gave out of their poverty more than they could be expected, and perhaps more than even thought wise they gave out of their poverty. And Paul says they did this of their own accord. This word, of their own accord, could go with what precedes it or with what follows after it. If it's part of verse 3, then he's saying that the giving was spontaneous and voluntary. If it's part of verse 4, he says that they were urgently pleading to participate entirely on their own. They wanted in on this. They had not been asked. Paul had not specifically asked them, but they heard about it and they wanted to get in and to give and to help others. And that reading would imply that Paul had not asked them to participate, which is a possibility. In fact, in 1 Corinthians 16, Paul only mentions giving directions for the collection to the Corinthians and to the churches of Galatia. Doesn't mention Macedonia. Paul's primary reason for emphasizing that the Macedonians responded voluntarily is to make it clear to the Corinthians that he did not constrain them in any way, that Paul was not forcing the Philippians to give something in this thing. They volunteered. Either they volunteered to give or they volunteered to participate. But they volunteered. Paul encourages the Corinthians also to give willingly. I think he's pointing to the Macedonians as an example. The Macedonians considered it a privilege to give. Some translations have the word privilege there. And that is really the same word grace that we see ringing throughout these chapters. Again, the grace of God. They didn't plea poverty to evade giving. Instead, they pled with Paul to give and to help. By contrast, Paul has to plead with the affluent Corinthians to give. Paul's the one doing the pleading here with the church in Corinth. Paul gives the impression that he was initially taken aback by the Macedonians' eagerness and their generosity. They gave beyond their means, and they did so without Paul's encouragement or coercion, let alone his insistence. If it comes from grace, then it can't come from coercion. They gave beyond anything that he might have anticipated, because they gave themselves to this work. The quantity does not matter. It's the spirit that Paul's referring to here. You know, with God, a couple of mites can far outweigh a ton of gold. And I think that's the attitude here. Paul never mentions the word money here in this context. He cloaks the whole enterprise in this language of this theological emphasis. It's a ministry that he is doing and carrying out, and he wants them to participate. As you look through this chapter, you see this theological language that Paul uses. Grace, partnership, sharing, service, ministry, earnestness, love, willingness, generosity, abundance, blessing, generous gifts, good work, righteousness, service. Those are the words that Paul uses throughout these two chapters. You know, in the process, Paul created a new meaning for the word translated partnership or fellowship in these verses. This is the first use we know of where that's applied to these monetary collections that Paul is taking up here. The Philippians had formed a partnership with Paul in his mission work. We see that in Philippians 1 and in chapter 4. All the Macedonian churches wanted to be a part of this partnership with other Christians in Judea. They begged to participate. and we see a new use of that word for fellowship as they wanted to be partners in the gospel. Verse 5 that we read a moment ago, the literal rendering of the Greek that they gave not as we had hoped suggests to English ears maybe some disappointment on Paul's part, when in truth, what they did was beyond his hopes, far beyond his hopes, far beyond any reasonable hope they gave. The word first that used there is a word of emphasis, of importance, not a word of time. It means they first, of most importance, they gave of themselves. And he says, they gave of themselves to us, he says, which means they dedicated themselves to Paul's project. I think that phrase shows that Paul recognized that how important the church's relationship to him was in the success of this ministry. And as we know, there was a very strained relationship between Paul and the Corinthian congregation. If they were not willing to give themselves to Paul and to his work, then they were very unlikely to give themselves to this work of Paul in the church in Jerusalem. And this past enmity between Paul and these Corinthians, I think, threatened to suspend their participation. The Macedonians' eagerness to participate, I think, allowed Paul to use them as a model for the Corinthians. And I think he's also bringing out the Philippians' loyalty to Paul in a subtle way and telling the Corinthians they also should have this loyalty to him because of what he had done for them in bringing the gospel to their city. I think, though, he leaves the Corinthians again to draw the proper inferences. He's not beating them about the head with this. He's laying out the Macedonians, and he's waiting for the Corinthians to draw the proper inferences. With the phrase, by the will of God, in that verse, Paul makes more specific that the impetus for this generosity comes from God. It's related to God's grace. Paul attributes it not to his own ministry or to their own selfless action. Paul attributes it to God working in them, the grace of God. Barclay has a wonderful thing to say here. He says, Paul says a very fine thing about the Macedonians. He says that first of all, they gave themselves, and so indeed they did. Two of them stand out above all the others, Barclay writes. There was Aristarchus of Thessalonica. He was with Paul on the last journey to Rome. Like Luke, he must have come to a great decision. Paul was under arrest and on his way to trial before the emperor. There was only one way in which Aristarchus could have accompanied him, and that was by enrolling himself as Paul's slave. Aristarchus, in the fullest sense, gave himself. There was Epaphroditus. When Paul was in prison in the later days, he came to him with a gift from Philippi. And there in prison he fell grievously ill. As Paul said of him, he nearly died for the work of Christ, Philippians 2. These Macedonian Christians gave themselves to the work of the Lord. Is it any surprise that they begged to be able to contribute and give money to this work in Jerusalem? What a wonderful attitude. I think Paul is contrasting the Philippians turning outward with the Corinthians turning inward. And the Philippians, if anybody could have turned inward, the Philippians, they were in poverty, they were being persecuted, they were suffering. Turn in? No, they turned outward. The Corinthians, if anybody had been in a position to turn outward, no. They were the rich, they turned inward. That's the contrast I think Paul is making. Verses 6 through 8. Insomuch that we desired Titus, that as he had begun, so he would also finish in you the same grace also. Therefore, as ye abound in everything, in faith, in utterance, in knowledge, and in all diligence, and in your love to us, see that you abound in this grace also. I speak not by commandment, but by occasion of the forwardness of others, and to prove the sincerity of your love. Paul now turns from the example of the Macedonians to the Corinthians' responsibility in this ministry. Their initial zeal for this venture had evidently flagged, and they need more coaxing to ensure that they will do what they had originally promised to do. Their waning commitment to this project is most likely attributable to the deteriorating relation between them and the Apostle Paul that culminated in that painful visit and that sorrowful letter that we studied before. You know, we also have seen these shadowy opponents of the apostle lurking in the background, and Paul will have more to say about them as this letter proceeds. But I think they're also likely behind the lack of zeal for this collection. I think they were undermining it, and they were undermining Paul's influence. And you know what? Scuttling that collection would have left a lot more money available for them. Charges of some kind of fraud may also have been lurking in the background. We've seen hints of that in Paul's discussions elsewhere. He refused to accept money from the Corinthians for his own support. And that may have fed some vicious rumors that he was planning on siphoning off some of these funds so he could get the support but not owe them anything. I mean, who knows the rumors that were being spread there about the Apostle Paul. We don't know what was the cause for certain behind the procrastination. But Paul here is capitalizing on something. There was a renewed goodwill toward Paul that had come from this visit that Paul is talking about, because they had done the right thing with the offending brother that we studied, and there was a renewed sense of goodwill. So Paul is now raising the issue again. They like him again, so let's raise this again and see if we can get that money and help these people in Jerusalem and do what they need to do. And I think that's another reason why these chapters are right here in this letter where they should be, in chapters 8 and 9, after chapter 7, where Paul has talked about this renewed goodwill that they have. You know, Paul has urged Titus to return to Corinth to help them fulfill their earlier promise. The verb used there means to complete successfully something already begun. They had already started. Titus is supposed to help them resume that and help them finish what they started. Verse 6 is really, I think, a delicate admonition to the Corinthians to follow through with what they had initially committed to do. Rather than scold them for not having finished, Paul instead praises them for their initial enthusiasm, with the emphasis being, and you need to continue with that initial enthusiasm. They were still in the beginning stages. They had not continued through with the project. In verse 7, Paul continues his affirmation by praising them for excelling in almost everything: faith, speech, knowledge, earnestness, love. Some see this as kind of a barbed tribute. One commentator says, well, you know, he's being totally sincere. He compliments them on its faith, hope, and charity, or their partnership in the God. No, Paul was being totally sincere here. He'd already talked about them having an overflowing, an abundance of gifts. And he also talked about the Macedonians being overflowing with generosity. It's the same word. I think Paul's point here is that, Corinth, you've got this overflowing of gifts. It needs to become an overflowing of generosity. It's the same word that Paul uses to describe both. Paul lists these gifts in two triads: faith, speech, and knowledge, earnestness, love, and grace. We've talked about the spiritual gifts before. We won't go over all of that. And I think those first three are these spiritual gifts that Paul recognized that they had. But you know what? Paul had talked about them earlier. And what was Paul's concern with their spiritual gifts that they were so good at? He was concerned that they focused on the individual. There you see it again, the theme. They turned inward. Their great spiritual gifts focused inward. He's saying, no, you need to focus outward. That's the gift you need. That's the generosity you need. So again, I think subtly we see that theme, inward versus outward. He confirms their eagerness or their zeal. And they had been eager. They had been zealous to do what was right with regard to the offending brother. And he wants them to show that same zeal for the collection. The next gift there, there's a knotty textual problem with it. Some texts read, your love among us, and other texts read, our love among you. And you think, well, how could that have snuck in the manuscripts? When that's pronounced in Greek, it sounds exactly the same. So it's probably that two people were copying it down, two scribes, and one heard one thing and one heard the other thing. And there are various arguments for which way it could be meant. Some say, well, our love for you is probably best because Paul had already said they'd squeezed him out of their hearts. Remember, we studied that. And so Paul is talking about our love for you, but I think that really disturbs the sense here. And elsewhere, Paul writes that he wants them to make their zeal for him known. That gives the impression that it was always there. It was just not known. It was not visible. And I think later, Paul will talk about testing them to see the genuineness of their love. So I think it's their love that's under consideration here. I think now, after they've done the right thing in chapter 7, Paul recognizes that they do have a love for him, even though it may have been hard to spot in some of the earlier controversies. The phrase, see that you abound in this grace also, reads literally in order that you abound in this grace also. It most likely is an imperative. See that you abound in this grace also. But it's expressed more as a wish than a command. One commentator said it's one of the least direct ways that Paul could use to express the imperative, the command. And that's a marked contrast with Paul's first letter in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, where he turned to the Corinthians and he said, do what I told the Galatians to do. Imperative. You do it, he said in 1 Corinthians 16. Here it's more of a wish. Apparently the relationship was, we know it was strained, we know it's back, but apparently Paul no longer feels free to make the direct commands he made earlier. So now he's saying, almost, I wish you would do what you said you would do earlier. But again, he lays out the principles. He doesn't give a rule. He lays out the principles here in hopes that they will see what they need to do to follow the example of Christ. But Paul is not shy at all about telling them that they need to abound in graciousness and charity. It's the abundance of this second triad of gifts, earnestness, love, and grace, that determines whether any of the gifts in that first grouping have any spiritual validity at all. A deficiency in the second group calls into question what they're doing in that first group. Paul has already talked about the participation of the Macedonian churches as a sure sign that God's grace had been given to them. He wants the Corinthians' participation to reveal whether God's grace has been given to them also. And he wants to see that at work among them. In verse 8, Paul moves cautiously. He doesn't want to give the impression that he's giving them orders. He's already said he doesn't want to be domineering over their faith, chapter 1, verse 24. He doesn't want them to give because of external compulsion. They're being commanded to give. You know, in his letter to Philemon, he did the same thing. He wanted the right thing to be done there, because not because of an order being given. He takes freedom in Christ very seriously. They can choose to take part or not. Their participation is voluntary. But Paul wants them to know the principles that should be at work in their lives, the grace of God at work in their lives. And he hopes that that will then cause them to respond with an outflowing of generosity to others. And that doesn't mean that Paul just sits by passively, hoping they'll do the right thing. That's hardly what he's doing here in chapters 8 through 9. He's their spiritual director. He's outlining the reasons why they should contribute. He doesn't want them giving for the wrong reasons. But you know, as one commentator I think correctly noted, we shouldn't ignore the fact that the discipline of giving, even for the wrong reasons, may eventually lead to a person giving for the right reasons. But Paul had the highest expectations of these Corinthians, that they would give for the right reasons. The life of faith always brings its tests, and Paul equates the collection with a test. He says in chapter 2, verse 9, that he wrote the letter of tears to see if they would stand the test, that he might know their character. They passed that test. Now he moves to another test. The Macedonians came through in a severe test of affliction, and they gave generously. For the Corinthians, it's a test of their love to see if it's genuine, if it's authentic. We already know from the first chapter that Paul thought their love needed more work. And here Paul is testing them. What will they do when faced with that test? Love in that sentence doesn't have an object. It could refer to their love for Paul or their love for Christ. Paul speaks earlier, though, of the love for Christ constraining him in all that he does. It's possible that he intends for them to show their love for Christ and Christ's love for them by showing their love for their fellow Christians. But Paul knows that words expressing love come cheaply and can be faked. Genuine love will show up in the checkbook. You know, that may sound crass, but that's as true today as it was in the first century. Verse 9, "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that through his poverty might be rich." What an incredible verse. What a magnificent verse. I mean, that's a life-changing verse. Verse 9. Paul increases the potency of his entreaty by appealing now to the example of Jesus Christ. The sacrifice of the Macedonians for others is one thing. The sacrifice of Christ for others is quite another. As one put it, the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ denotes the utterly undeserved, royally free, effective, unwearying, inexhaustible goodwill of God, active in and through Jesus Christ, God's effective, overflowing mercy. It sums up God's merciful action toward humanity. When we've been the beneficiaries of such undeserved grace, how can we shut our purses, our hearts to others in need, begrudge them every penny that we could share with them? 1 John 3:17, "Whoso hath this world's good and seeth his brother have need and shutteth up his bowels of compassion, how dwelleth the love of God in him?" John asked. God's lavishness in the gift of grace and the depths of Christ's sacrifice requires that Christians be liberal in giving, helping others. A half-hearted response ill befits the total sacrifice that Christ made for us. Paul talks about Christ similarly in Philippians 2, 5 through 11, about emptying himself. Though he was rich, means Christ did not exploit his status for his own advantage. Instead, he relinquished that status and gave it up for others. We will continue on with verse 9 next week. I have much more to say on verse 9. We only scratched the surface of verse 9. It is possible that next week I will not be the one saying it, though, because there's a chance I will be leaving for Australia on Friday to be coming back on Christmas Eve. And yes, it is a business trip. So I hope you will be praying for that trip, if in fact it happens. And if it does, my co-teacher will be picking up in verse 9 next week. Thank you very much for your attention.